Welcome to Philly Fortune Talks with your host, Jake Penny, where the city's brightest minds share the secrets behind their success. Are you ready to be inspired?
What's going on, everybody? My name is Jake Penny, the host of Philly Fortune's podcast. Today, I have the opportunity of having my guest speaker, Justin Saracini, here, who works in private equity. Justin, how are you today?
Good, man. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I would love for you to give your little brief bio to the audience so they can get to know you a little bit better.
Sounds good. Yeah. So, born and raised Central Pennsylvania, I wasn't really particularly a good student, but it wasn't because I didn't, I wasn't smart. It's just because I didn't really apply myself through high school and college. I was kind of like a B student. I studied supply chain and got out in the world. I had some early success with some corporate companies and got an opportunity to go work for a family operated thrift store chain. I said, okay, I didn't really know much about thrift stores, but I interviewed with them and I saw that I could make a pretty big impact with the things that I've learned. Over the course of being there, I co-invented with the owner a new brand on how to basically collect product for thrift stores. And through that, we had a lot of success. The owner brought on some private equity partners. When I was there, I went through three different transactions. As part of that, had the opportunity to get some equity in the business. Two phases of that, to put my own money into the business as well, and just kind of bet on myself. And, here I am, 15, 16 years later after going through that transition. And it's something I really love doing and enjoy. And it's been pretty fruitful for me.
Awesome. And did you is that what you went to school for, to get into the thrift chain? Or how did that, go? How did you stumble upon that? And then, obviously get into having equity in these companies and whatnot?
Yeah, so my background is really supply chain related, like supply chain logistics. When I got out in the work world, I was really into process improvement, like Six Sigma, black belt stuff. I actually had a really great mentor early in my career at Armstrong World Industries. And he just kind of taught me like continuous improvement, right? Just kind of always making things better. And when I went to work for the thrift store, it really was starting as a supply chain guy, right? To come in and optimize the supply chain. But I was just the guy in the room when there was something to figure out. I just raised my hands and said, I'll figure it out, right? And I just became taking on more responsibility, like whether it was maintenance, real estate, FP&A, finance, I would just say, hey, I'll figure it out. And then I kind of mastered the trait and then hired and backfilled my position, replaced myself, brought good people in, and just kind of continued to learn and grow. So it was really a natural progression of just kind of being a guy who always said, yeah, I'll figure it out, right? Not to shy away from a challenge.
Yeah. I mean, that's how you become successful, is always fall forward and take the challenge on. If you're got to be uncomfortable, well, comfortable being uncomfortable, as they say.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, a lot of people think that private equity is like this big, sexy, thing, but a lot of people can get started in, fairly easy, maybe not easy, but in something not so sexy. Because a lot of people think like, oh, it's these huge merger acquisition companies and things of that nature, when there's a ton of opportunity in other parts of private equity that the mainstream doesn't share.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, part of it was just like right place, right time, right industry, right? Like the thrift industry had a lot of tailwinds behind it, a lot of private equity investors wanting to get into a space. It was also a space that, other than one of the biggest players in the space, was a lot of still original family members owns a lot of these chains, and a lot of private equities like to be first money into these businesses. Obviously a lot of hard work to build the company from where it started to where it was, where private equity would be interested in it, but also just kind of being there, right? And once you're there and you become a master in the space, and it's a space that's still pretty hot, there's a lot of opportunities.
Right. So what was one of the biggest bumps that you hit, like a roadblock? Can you share something that happened and didn't totally pan out and how you got through it?
So I'm a pretty like calculated risk guy, right? So usually I'm kind of paying for my mistakes ahead of time, right? Like if I have something at work, I got some opportunity, I'll be a little conservative and then I'll take a risk somewhere else, right? So I mean, I can think of a few things where I hit some roadblocks, but they were almost intended. Like I signed a few leases on places just to kind of get in, because you know there's challenges with a lot, not a lot of landlords wanting to lease to me, right? So maybe I took a location that I knew wasn't going to be an A plus winner, but just because I needed a flagship in the market to get other people behind the fact that I could deliver a high quality product, right? I wasn't Sanford and Sons, right? Like it was a nice presentable thing. And so, yeah, I mean, I took a couple of hits on those locations, but they opened the door to other locations that I never would have had a shot for, right? So it was painful to kind of muscle through those, you know, early months and years on some of those locations, but then it, you know, it all panned out.
Yeah, it definitely probably opened the floodgates to other parts of that market over
Sure.
time.
Yeah.
Got it. Now, it seems like you have to have like a lot of leadership and management within the thrift industry. So, talk a little about how leadership plays a role, management, because you told me in the past about a little bit how the thrifting works, and it seems like there is a lot of back and forth all the time going for suppliers. You know, selling what goods can't be sold in stores to overseas. It seems like a lot that goes on a day-to-day basis. So what does that look like?
Yeah, it's a really interesting business model, right? So it's a retail front with a manufacturing in the back room, right? Tens of thousands of items per day going out onto the floor. It's a supply chain and logistics company. It's a marketing company because we have to go out and source all of our own product. It's not like we could call a supplier in China and say, deliver me jeans. We got to go out and source them. So it's real, and all of those are all interconnected, right? If something changes in marketing, well, that changes the source of product that comes in, which changes the store, which changes the retail, and vice versa, right? So there's just a lot of understanding the connecting points. So building a team around that is really important. Building good KPIs, good systems, good processes to kind of understand and manage that and react. The challenge in our space is not to overreact, right? So like you say, hey, I want to increase prices, you know, a little 5%. Well, then you come in and it's really hard to do when you don't have everything is one of one, right? So if I want to increase prices a little bit, they might just go a little crazy. You see your prices go up by 20% because it's very difficult to do it when we're not dealing with a widget. Everything that comes through the back room is unique. So just good systems, good controls, and empowering good people is really the key.
Got it. And what do you see the most success in coming through the strip stores? So, like, what's like the hottest thing that you know has the biggest margins and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, we really want to be well-rounded. We want it all, right? Like the worst thing for us is to get like I can't do anything with like 1,000, you know, of nice polos, right? Like, oh, that's a really nice polo, right? But the shoppers come in for like one of one. So we have a really high velocity of our product, right? It sits on the floor for 4 weeks, so our inventory turns are really fast. So for like if the shirt, right? If I had 50 of these shirts, I couldn't sell 50 of these shirts in 4 weeks, right?
Yeah.
And it would take up too much space. So we're really looking for a little bit of kids, some toys, some household items, some ladies, some men's. So we really want the well-rounded product. We're really a department store with secondhand product.
Got it. So they come in, they grab a shirt, and they're going to grab a kid's toy, you know, and whatnot. They're not going to grab, you know, five of the same shirt or something like that. Just a little bit of everything in that day that they're shopping.
Yeah, and there's different customer profiles, right? There's the buyers that like buy stuff and ship it overseas. There's like the DIYers, there's the need-based customer, right? There's all different customer personas and they all have different buying behaviors.
Okay, so yeah, you give your clients little avatars, and that's how you profile the stock that you bring in. Now, how does that look like on the back end? You said, you know, you try to turn like a 4 week cycle. Stuff that comes in through the doors that doesn't turn in 4 weeks, what does that look like? How do you drop the prices? Do you sell it to a wholesaler? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we have a discount cadence, right? Most thrift stores have a discount cadence. So after a certain number of days on the floor, it'll go on sale for like say 50% off, then it drops to 75% off. And then once you get to that like third, fourth week, we just pull it off the floor. We take it off the floor. It's called rag out in the industry. So you're just taking it out. And rag is a term that's used for like industrial clothes that's recycled and sent overseas. So that stuff is then sold, repurposed, usually going to either South America, Central America, Asia, Africa, and it's getting resold in its intended form for the most part, like just going to maybe a secondhand store in those countries. And then ultimately, the items that are not sold are broken down and for like fiber or industrial wiper cloth or PET filling and things of that nature. So it really is a very green industry, and the goal is to really find a home ultimately for as much of that stuff as we can, repurpose it, keep it out of landfills.
Got it. Yeah, I think you were telling me before, like a lot of the t-shirts that you guys don't sell, don't they get like bleached and they become like auto mechanic cloths or something like that?
Yeah, so if you ever go into Home Depot and you see the big, like boxes of industrial wiper cloth, I mean, that's really a byproduct from the recycling industry that comes from used textiles.
Got it. Yeah, because I remember growing up in my dad's auto body shop, and they would always have like this big cardboard box that just ripped
Exactly.
up, looked like ripped up white t-shirts. So that's pretty cool that they actually recycle those and repurpose them. Staying on top of any industry is like super hard, especially probably with thrifting and private equity. So what do you do on a daily basis to stay on top of your game, and what exciting things do you see coming up on the horizon that you're getting ready for?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of tailwinds for the industry as a whole, right? So I stay on top of a lot of there's industry publications, there's a private or publicly traded companies that put out information. So it's really just reading what comes down the pike, not only just specific for thrift, but for retail, for real estate, supply chain. Like I told you before, like our industry, although thrift, you think retail, it's manufacturing, it's retail, it's logistics and supply chain. So within each of those, it's IT. All of our IT is for the most part custom built, right? You really can't buy a lot of stuff off the shelf for our industry other than, POS system at the counter. So it's really well-rounded and have to get a lot of information from different trade articles and things of that nature as well. So,
Okay,
yeah.
got it. So you're learning as you go all the time.
Always learning, always trying new things. And another thing is just, you're staying close. It's a very small community, right? There's not a lot of people that do what we do. And just over the years have created some good contacts. And just, I actually have a call on Friday with a guy that, used to be a consultant that implemented a lot of technologies at thrift stores. And we're just going to touch base to talk about the business. What's new? What's going on? What are you seeing in these different markets? So a lot of it is also relationship based and relationship building.
That's good because a lot of the industries out there are just cutthroat, and it's more competition than collaboration. So it's nice that you have that tribe mentality within the thrifting community.
Yeah, there's still some of the cutthroat too, but
I bet you can't get away from it. Sucks to say, but so for a high achiever like yourself, with thrifting and private equity and just on a day-to-day basis, what does your life look like daily? I know you're very into meditation, always having your mind right, spirituality, and personal development. So, what do you do on a daily basis? What does that look like, and how you got started on that journey?
yeah. So yeah, professional and personal development is a big part of my life. So I really have adopted, I'm sure a lot of people have kind of read like the Miracle Morning book, right? So I've kind of adopted my own philosophy or process for that. I'm an early riser. I get up early, typically in the 5 o'clock hour. Just depends on the day. I get up, I do my meditation. I share like a video update with a mastermind group, a group of guys that I'm in on just where I'm at, check in on their stuff. I go to the gym, I work out for an hour, I come home, see my family for a little bit, get cleaned up and get to work. And then in the afternoons, I try to shut it down a little bit and be present for my family, make sure I'm kind of well-rounded. So I try to adopt a similar strategy when I'm on the road and when I'm traveling. But for me, I'm very regimented with my week too. Like Sunday nights or Monday mornings, I don't take a call, I don't schedule a meeting until I plan on my week and what I want to accomplish and my priorities. get my team dialed in. I think that's the most important part of my week is that planning. And then I actually have it right here. I just jot notes throughout the week on what I need to do for the following week. What's, you know, what are my hot priorities for different people or different vendors that I work with? So it's a lot of what I do is making sure that the people that I'm working with for, and where are they on task? Are they doing what they need to do? Am I getting what I need out of them? And then I can kind of focus on what I need to do.
Okay. Nice. And you journal and everything. And like, so do you do like meditation? Do you work out in the morning? What is that like? What does that power hour look like, or that miracle look like for you?
Yeah, so it's usually like 5 to 10 minutes of like silence and meditation. It's journaling, the video post, hour of workout, healthy breakfast, just kind of some alone time in the car. I like that. Like I drive to a gym that's 15 minutes away when I can go to one that's 2 minutes away, just because I kind of like that headspace time in the morning. And that's really it. And then I kind of get right into it after that. So I've really abbreviated that. There's been times in my life where that's been like my meditation process is alone has been 30 minutes, but I found that it's important for me to do it, but I don't need to do it as long as I was doing it before to still get the benefit. So I've really kind of condensed that, and found different areas to kind of replace it. Like when I'm at the gym, a lot of times, sometimes I'll listen to music, but I'll throw on a podcast, personal development podcast to kind of push myself. And I get a lot of content, just from a video share that I do with a group of guys every day. I got to hear what they're listening to and what are their key learnings from different things. So it's kind of like a little hack where I can get the knowledge of five people in, you know, a fifth of the time just by kind of staying connected with them. And that's something I do every day. It's called Marco Polo. I think you've used it before, Jake, where I'm in a group of five guys. We post every day on kind of what's going on. And it's that's really been a game changer for me this year in terms of just mindset and trying to be a well-rounded person, not just a, you know, a well-rounded business person, family, health, and as well as work goals. So.
You know, what I really liked how you said you travel an extra 15 minutes to the gym in the morning when you could use the gym that's 2 minutes away just to have the headspace and do deeper thinking by yourself. It's funny too, because like I was on the way to the gym yesterday or the day, I think it was the day before, and it took me 30 minutes to get to the gym, which usually it takes about 15. Just I went at the wrong time, traffic. And instead of focusing on, man, I shouldn't have gone, or this traffic sucks, I should have took the opportunity to have a deeper thoughts with myself. Just like, oh, okay, this is okay. Now I can think amongst myself.
I honestly feel like that is the most important work that I do during the course of the week is from the time I finish my meditation and I get in my car to the time I get home and get in the shower, and even in the shower, because I'm thinking it's not random for me to, you know, I have some people that work in, on the West Coast and work in the middle of the country, and I'm texting them when I'm at the gym, hey, I got an idea, or I'm just taking notes. So it's a very productive thought time for me, and very, it's like kind of the creative zone of genius, zone of excellence type stuff where it's otherwise you get into the grind. If I didn't wake up early, it would just be kind of right into the grind where that's really my creative thought time on, well, what am I doing next? What's innovative that I can be doing coming down the pipeline? Thinking about something I heard on a board call the night before. How can I get better? How can I take this feedback? It's a really important time for me. And that period is probably from, you know, 5 a.m. till about 8. So it really ends up being like 3 hours where I'm not interrupted. I don't have family. It's just me, and I'm focused on getting better.
That's sweet. I do really like, you know, just total serenity and silence with myself sometimes. I'm an only child growing up, so I'm totally fine with not talking or doing any of that stuff. But I wish I had more of it, or just to think of that when going to the gym or just in the car in general, instead of putting on music, just have deep thoughts with myself. Sometimes it's kind of awkward, I feel, when I have another person in the car with me. You know, so it's like when I go to the gym by myself, it's definitely more like, you know, I can process a lot more. I just haven't been able to shut that off to where it's like, oh man, another person's in the car. It's kind of funky.
I'm not a social person in the morning. I'm awake, I'm active, but I want that time to myself. Very selfish of mornings.
I couldn't agree more. The morning is totally my time. I don't really, it's not that I don't want to talk to people. It's just like I just want to be able to wake up on my terms and just, be able to process everything in the morning and just not have to, I don't put that extra bandwidth out to talk to anybody first thing. So being a high performer like yourself, how do you approach financial planning to ensure stability and growth? Because obviously, that's a big thing when you're a high performer is, also financial management and everything.
Yeah, so my strategy I've evolved over the last 5 to 10 years, but when I first kind of started to learn about some alternate investments outside of like say the stock market and 401ks and all that stuff, I was like, oh, I want to be in real estate. And then I realized the lift that it would take, and my best and highest use is what I'm doing. That's my highest earning potential is the craft that I have developed and that I'm executing on now. So for me to be successful in real estate, I couldn't do that and this together. So I really started to kind of bet on different horses, right? So there's ways to be in real estate and in alternate investments, but I'm really doing it more on a relationship basis on people that have proven track records. And yeah, sure, I may not get the returns by doing the deal myself, but I get consistent diverse returns by investing in small businesses or real estate or private lending. So it does take, nothing is 100% passive, but it doesn't take as much of my time to be able to have a diverse portfolio. And my goal is that my passive or I guess I'd call it horizontal income is to get 200% of what it costs for me to live. And I'm continuing to make progress at that every year and just chip away at it. I have started to invest more than I had in previous years in just kind of like traditional, assets like the stock market and 401k and things like that. And I think it's just because it's something I neglected for a while. I was really kind of much more into my real estate investments and small business investments. So yeah, over time, I've been putting more of a focus there because I think it's I was getting a little bit too lopsided. So
Okay.
that's kind of how I approach it. And where I'm at now, I'm just over the 100%er mark and I'm on my way to the 200. And for me, that's when it's not like I'm going to quit there, but that's the goal.
Yeah, that's the next that's the top of the mountain or the
That's
next
the
goal in
fear.
line.
Yeah. And then I'll see the next peak after that, right?
Yeah. Definitely, that's for sure. But that's really cool though. You cut out the middleman. Of lending per se to businesses and to real estate owners, and you became a bank. And now you get to make all that money because it's really funny. I forget who put it out, but a well-known article I read a couple months ago that said the bank at an average bank makes anywhere between 600 and 1300% for every dollar that you put in the bank through fractional reserves. And them lending every single dollar out, in which your money's never even there anyway, it's just a dollar on the screen. So, people are already lending money on a daily basis when every time they deposit a check into the bank, because the bank then lends that money back out to other people through credit cards, bank finance, real estate, car loans, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really cool that you cut out the middleman and now you're starting to make those great, predictable, secure returns.
Yeah, it's been significantly, I wouldn't say life-changing, but lifestyle changing, right? It's makes life a lot easier when you're able to do that.
Awesome, Justin. So as we close here, what are some, big things on the horizon for you or any golden nuggets that you can drop for advice that for somebody that may want to follow in your footsteps? And then this is a three-piece question. So follow along with me. If
Yeah.
there also is any services that you provide that the audience might benefit from, let us know.
Sure. Yeah. So the following in the footsteps thing, my advice would be don't follow my footsteps, create your own path, right? And I think that's I can't, I'm not going to say like I'm a groundbreaker or anything, but I really do think what I do, not only for a profession, but also how I invest is unique, right? It's a, different people do different things, but a combination of the two. A lot of people, I know when I was younger and I was kind of just coming up and figuring out what I want to do and how am I going to get to the next level, I was looking at other people and what they achieved and thinking I wanted what they wanted. And I could have made a really bad mistake, right? If I would have, like, I almost kind of quit my job and went and did something else, because I was chasing what other people were successful at. And if I would have done that, I probably would not be in the position I'm in today. Said I doubled down on myself. I took a little bit of a risk. I had a handshake deal on equity. I didn't really have equity the first time around, and I decided to stick it out. So my advice is do what works for you. Don't chase other people's dreams. Don't try to emulate other people. That's the best advice I could give is don't look at me and be like, oh, I like what that guy, like his car or his house, whatever. Like, do your own thing, man. That's my advice. In terms of services that I offer, like I used to do coaching. I just don't anymore because I'm too busy. So there's not a whole lot I can offer anybody other than, I'm always good for a good talk about personal development, or I'm happy to lend advice to anybody. But I'm pretty good at building a team, right? I tend to give a lot of people advice, small business owners and friends, about how to kind of build a team around them. So that I think those are the questions I field the most. But other than that, unfortunately, I'm not taking on any coaching clients anymore, just based off of the best return on my time.
There you go. Not a problem with that. Stay in your lane, what works, and don't chase the shiny object syndrome.
That's right.
Cool, Justin. Well, it was a pleasure having you on Philly Fortune Podcast, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Philly Fortune Talks with Jake Penny. Inspired to share your success story? Visit PhillyFortuneTalks.com/guest and let's inspire together.